And now, the man your mother warned you about, Mike Cannon.
Welcome back to this week's Mike Cannon Show. Up next will be This Way Out, which will be followed by shorter segments including, but not limited to, Media Minutes, Radio Spin, Black Agenda Radio, and In Season with Lisa. That's the type of alternative non-corporate voices you get each and every week right here on the Mike Cannon Show. And I'd like to thank you for listening.
You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
For 28 years, we have been engaged. We can now register at Home Depot as we prepare for marriage.
I'm thrilled that our soon-to-be 11-year-old is going to understand that his parents are married just like all his friends.
This decision is an outrage.
پارسال من نگفتم وجود ندارن، گفتم این جوری که در اینجا هست در ایران نیست.
I didn't say they don't exist. I said not the way they are here.
Welcome to This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Connecticut's constitution demands marriage equality, Uganda's ethics head wants to outlaw being gay, and Iran's president is pressed for queer answers. All that and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
And I'm Donna Ann Ward.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending October 11th, 2008. The Connecticut Supreme Court, in a 4-3 decision issued on October 10th, ruled that same-gender couples should be able to marry in the state. The majority said that even though civil unions for lesbi-gay couples have been available in Connecticut for about 3 years, granting virtually all the rights of marriage but the name, such a separate category violated the state constitution's guarantees of equal protection under the law. Justice Richard N. Palmer wrote for the majority that, because the institution of marriage carries with it a status and significance that the newly created classification of civil unions does not embody, the segregation of heterosexual and homosexual couples into separate institutions constitutes a cognizable harm. Melinda Tuhus filed this report from New Haven for Free Speech Radio News.
Connecticut legalized civil unions for same-sex couples in 2005, but many advocates have been pushing for the right to marry. Ann Stanback, director of Love Makes a Family, said this victory was 8 years in the making.
It is a historic ruling. I think that the court said very clearly that civil unions are a separate and unequal status, and I think people will be getting married before the end of this year, for sure.
The ruling in Kerrigan and Mock et al. Versus Department of Public Health came 17 months after the case was argued at the state Supreme Court. Connecticut joins Massachusetts and California as the only states allowing full marriage rights for same-sex couples. For FSRN, I'm Melinda Tuhus in New Haven.
The Boston-based gay and lesbian advocates and defenders filed the case in 2004 on behalf of 8 Connecticut same-gender couples after they were denied marriage licenses. That prompted the state legislature to pass a civil unions law the next year that was intended to satisfy marriage equality advocates. The lawsuit proceeded up the judicial ladder, however, as gay and lesbian couples continued to demand full marriage rights.
In one of 3 separate dissents, Justice Peter Zarella argued that any decision on same-gender marriage should be left to the legislature. Lawmakers, however, have been reluctant since passing the civil unions measure to take that step. State Attorney General Richard Blumenthal, whose office represented the state in the case, said the decision will take effect on October 28th and that it can't be appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court because the case involved the state constitution, not federal law. But there's a proposal on the November ballot asking voters whether or not the state should convene a constitutional convention to consider opening Connecticut to direct initiatives. Opponents of the court's marriage ruling support direct initiatives, which could enable them to put a constitutional marriage ban on the ballot. Peter Wolfgang of the Family Institute of Connecticut told reporters that Connecticut voters will have one opportunity on November 4th to reassert their right to self-government. We must vote yes. Meanwhile, the Iowa Supreme Court announced this week that it will hear arguments on December 9th in a case challenging that state's law banning same-gender marriage.
In California, earlier polls showed that Proposition 8 was losing. That November ballot measure would reverse the ruling issued by the state Supreme Court earlier this year and eliminate marriage equality for same-gender couples. TV and radio ads now running up and down the state by the better-funded proponents have changed the polling numbers. The ads argue that people could be sued for their personal beliefs, that the tax-exempt status of religious institutions would be endangered, and that young schoolchildren would be forced to learn about same-gender marriage. Lesbi-gay activists have called the claims in those ads outright lies. But the latest polls now show Proposition 8 favored by 47% of likely voters, with about 42% opposed. Major support for Proposition 8 has come from the U.S.-based Roman Catholic fraternal organization, Knights of Columbus, the rabidly anti-LGBT Focus on the Family, and several well-heeled members of the Mormon Church. While supposedly neutral in political matters, Mormon elders made a televised appeal to followers gathered at church buildings in California, Utah, Hawaii, and Idaho, urging them to work for the passage of Proposition 8. Voters in Arizona will also decide on a state constitutional amendment to ban same-gender marriage on November 4th.
The latest polls in Florida also show increasing support for a state constitutional amendment there that would not only ban same-gender marriage, but specify that no other legal union that is treated as marriage or the substantial equivalent thereof shall be valid or recognized. Opponents say such language would also prohibit civil unions or domestic partnerships, not only for lesbi-gay couples, but for unmarried heterosexual couples who live together but choose not to marry. Domestic partnerships are also favored by senior citizens, a major voting bloc in the state, who would lose government benefits by remarrying. Amending the state constitution requires a 60% vote in Florida, but recent polls show support for the ballot proposal has grown to 55%.
Elsewhere, Portugal's parliament this week voted by a large majority against a bill to allow gay and lesbian couples in the predominantly Roman Catholic country to marry. Prime Minister José Sócrates of the ruling Socialist Party had warned last week that such legislation was not on the government's agenda. Two minor leftist parties sponsored the civil marriage measure, but only 28 members in the 230-seat legislature voted for it.
Marriage equality for lesbi-gay couples will become legal in Norway on January 1st. But bishops of the Church of Norway voted this week against allowing pastors to perform weddings for those couples. The Lutheran denomination counts nearly 85% of the country's population as members. After what were reportedly hours of heated debate, bishops decided to allow pastors to recite a prayer for civilly married gay and lesbian couples, as long as it's not a formal blessing ceremony.
About 40 anti-gay Anglican church bishops from Africa, Australia, the U.S., India, and Canada took part in a conference last week near the Uganda capital of Kampala. It was a follow-up to a conference held in Jerusalem earlier this year by church traditionalists who oppose openly gay Anglican bishops, specifically Episcopalian Gene Robinson of New Hampshire, and the blessing of same-gender couples conducted primarily by Anglican clergy in North America. Bishops, other clergy, and laypeople from the Global South, Africa, Asia, and Latin America, formed what they called a church within a church in Jerusalem, saying that while they don't want to leave the global Anglican communion, they oppose its liberal wing and must act separately to support traditional biblical teachings against homosexuality. A bishop from southern India told reporters that, "We need to explain to those who disagree with us on the issue of taking the authority of the Bible as we do."
Uganda's leading Muslim cleric called last year for gay people to be rounded up and marooned on an island in Lake Victoria until they die. And the government of Uganda announced this week that they intend to strengthen the country's laws against homosexuality. Ethics and Integrity Minister James Butoro told a news conference that the state of moral health in our nation is challenging, and we are concerned about the mushrooming of lesbianism and homosexuality. Who is going to occupy Uganda 20 years from now if we all become homosexuals? We know that homosexuals don't reproduce. He blamed increasing globalization, charging that 10 years ago, this phenomenon was not here, but the disease has penetrated everywhere. Consensual adult same-gender sex is already outlawed in the East African country, punishable by up to life in prison. LGBT activists held a first-ever press conference in Kampala a year ago to demand basic civil rights. Fearing reprisals, many wore disguises. A coalition of Christian and Muslim groups filled a downtown stadium a week later, demanding the arrests of all gay people. Ugandan LGBT activists have been increasingly targeted by police for detention and abuse since then. Butoro said that new legislation would be introduced to prosecute anyone who simply comes out publicly as lesbian or gay.
But an estimated 10,000 LGBT people and their supporters came out for the 19th annual Pride festivities in Johannesburg, South Africa on October 4th. According to local media reports, 32 floats and many equally colorful marchers wound their way down the parade route to a multi-stage performance space featuring well-known DJs and drag entertainers. Love, not hate, was the overall theme this year, focusing on the troubling rise in anti-LGBT hate violence. While sexual orientation discrimination was outlawed in the country's post-apartheid constitution and marriage equality was established there in 2006, a number of black lesbians have been brutally murdered in the townships in recent months.
And finally, famous Italian comic Sabina Guzzanti will not be prosecuted for saying in July that Pope Benedict XVI will go to hell for the Roman Catholic Church's treatment of gay people. Justice Minister Angelino Alfano decided not to launch a formal investigation. A local prosecutor in Rome had charged that Guzzanti's comments broke a law that protects the dignity of the church. A Vatican spokesman said that the church approved of the decision to drop the matter.
That's News Wrap for the week ending October 11th, 2008, written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Donna Ann Ward.
And I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
What really happened in Mashhad, Iran on July 19th, 2005? We'll look for answers later in the program. Issuing a 4-3 ruling on October 10th, the Connecticut Supreme Court said that gay and lesbian couples in the state were entitled to full marriage equality. While civil unions established by the legislature 3 years ago provided virtually all the rights of marriage except the name, the court's majority decided that such second-class status violated the state constitution's guarantee of equal protection under the law. Bennett Klein of the Boston-based Gay and Lesbian Advocates and Defenders, or GLAAD, was one of the lead attorneys for the 8 plaintiff couples in the case. He addressed the media during a celebratory press conference that day.
Everybody understands that marriage is a unique institution with profound meaning for couples, that marriage is unparalleled in the dignity, respect, and protection that it gives to couples. And with today's decision, gay and lesbian families in Connecticut will now be able to marry and have the same protection and security as all other families in this state.
For most people, this is not a big issue. They don't think about gay people.
Mary Bonato, GLAAD's civil rights director.
What has happened in this state is that ordinary people have come to see these people, as neighbors, as co-workers, whether they're teachers or firefighters or whatever, they've come to see them as people who are parents of children in their schools. They've come to see that they worship in the same church or temple. They've come to see these people as human beings with the same inherent dignity that everyone else has. And when you have that recognition, then the question becomes, why is it exactly that only same-sex couples, only these two, are denied a right that everyone else has? And when you start asking that question and you start thinking about the humanity, the answer becomes pretty simple. In this country, we don't have two standards of law. We have one standard of justice for everyone, and that is the principle that the Connecticut Supreme Court vindicated today.
Mary Bonato put it so well that we are going to have outbreaks of happiness.
Ann Standback of the statewide marriage equality group, Love Makes a Family.
And I think given the gloomy economic news of the past few weeks, we all deserve many, many outbreaks of happiness. Today, same-sex couples who have made a lifelong promise to take care of and be responsible for each other
celebrate being welcomed into one of society's most fundamental institutions. And today, Connecticut can proudly and appropriately claim its nickname, the Constitution State. Thank you very much.
Opponents of the ruling held their own press conference called by the Family Institute of Connecticut. Executive Director Peter Wolfgang noted that even the state's so-called liberal legislature had resisted marriage equality efforts. He called for passage of a November ballot measure that could open the door to a statewide voter referendum on the issue.
This decision is an outrage. Our Supreme Court justices, instead of allowing us to govern ourselves, instead of allowing government, as Lincoln said, of the people, by the people, and for the people, have decided to appoint themselves our robed masters, our philosopher kings. Our judges today have said, you know what, we're going to reach down into the political process and all the really big questions of American democracy, questions about the sanctity of marriage, or on the federal level for many years now, questions about the sanctity of life. The judges will reach down and say, we'll take these really big questions out of the democratic process. And you little people with your elected representatives, well, they can focus on filling the potholes in your streets. There are now three states in the entire 50 United States, only three, that have same-sex marriage. And in all three, every one of them, it was forced on us by the court. There isn't a single state in the land where the people voted for same-sex marriage. But we have one opportunity. There will be a question on the ballot on November 4th asking state voters if they want to hold the Constitutional Convention. This question will not appear again for 20 years. This is our one opportunity to rise up to have something like the remedy they have in California.
For the time being, however, Connecticut becomes the third U.S. state to open marriage to lesbi-gay couples, joining Massachusetts and California, at least until the Golden State's November 4th election results. Some of the Connecticut plaintiffs now get the last words about their historic win.
I'm Janet Peck. This is my partner, Carol Conklin, soon to be my spouse, Carol Conklin, and it's a real thrill to be able to say that. For 33 years, my heart has ached for that moment. And today, I know that ache is going to now be replaced with tremendous, wonderful joy, and that our love that we felt for all these years will finally be complete. Thank you.
My name is Garrett Stack, and this is my partner, John Anderson, and for 28 years, we had been engaged. We can now register at Home Depot as we prepare for marriage. And as the Supreme Court decision said, marriage is much more than a bundle of rights and responsibilities. It comes to the soul of who we are as human beings. So we are just overjoyed and can't wait for another 28 more if God provides that. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Beth Kerrigan. It's my spouse to be, Jody Mock.
And this is me.
What's your name?
Fernanda.
And Carlos. Words can't express our absolute sense of joy and gratitude to the justices who made our lives that more special. We are just thankful and relieved, quite frankly. It's been a long haul, so thank you all.
I'm Robin Levine Ritterman, and my partner,
Barb Levine Ritterman.
And I'm thrilled that our soon-to-be 11-year-old, who looks at the pictures of the wedding commitment ceremony that we had in 1992 and just doesn't understand why we're not married. There's the pictures. There's the rabbi. Very soon, he's not going to have to, be confused anymore. He's going to understand that his parents are married just like all his friends. So thank you.
I'm Jeffrey Bush, and this is my fiancé, Stephen Davis. And this is our son, Elijah. And we have been together for almost 20 years. And today it feels like our world has changed due to the simplest of things, marriage. After 20 years, it still feels like the beginning. And I'm so looking forward to the rest of our lives together as a married couple. And Eli's going to be our ring bearer.
The world can change, it can change like
like that due to one little word, married. See a palace rise from a two-roomed flat due to one little word, married. And the old despair that was often there suddenly ceases to be. For you wake one day, look around and say, my lovely boyfriend, or if I were a lesbian, my girlfriend. But I'm not, so my boyfriend, married me.
Extra, extra, read all about it, extra.
A new This Way Out update has been posted on our website. For recent programming information and behind-the-scenes news about your favorite international LGBT radio show, log on to www.thiswayout.org.
Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's 2007 visit to the United States for a United Nations General Assembly meeting was marked by a controversial appearance at Columbia University, where he famously contended that there are no gays and lesbians in his country. While attending this year's UN gathering in late September, Ahmadinejad was interviewed by Democracy Now!'s Amy Goodman. That progressive and notoriously unembedded journalist pressed the president on the status of Iran's gays and lesbians and later got a response from activist Kourash Shemirani of Queer Iran Alliance.
When the Iranian president visited New York last year, he gave a speech at Columbia University. He was asked about attitudes to homosexuality in his country.
In Iran, we don't have homosexuals like in your country. We don't have that in our country.
On Wednesday, I asked the Iranian president to clarify his statement.
I didn't say they don't exist. I said not the way they are here.
در ایران این کاری عمل بسیار زشته.
In Iran, it's considered as a very unlikable and abhorrent act.
مردم از این کار بدشون میاد.
People simply don't like it.
دستورات دینی ما مخالف این هست.
Our religious decrees tell us that it's against.
همه ادیان الهی این کار زشت رو تقبیح کردن.
Our values and all divine laws actually believe in the same.
چه کسی اجازه داده که افراد همجنس بازی کنن؟
Who's given them permission to engage in
this?
It's considered as a.
بنیانهای جامعه رو متلاشی میکنه.
It shakens the foundations of a society.
بنیان خانواده رو متلاشی میکنه.
The family foundation.
انسانیت رو از بین میبره.
It robs humanity.
مریضی ها رو تو
It brings about diseases.
این افتخار نیست برای جامعه آمریکا که بگه ما از همجنس بازی حمایت میکنیم.
It should be of no pride to the American society to say that they defend homosexuality.
این اصلا کار خوبی نیست که به دیگران رو به خاطر اینکه ممنوع میکنن میخوایم اونها رو بدنام کنیم یا بگیم کار زشتی کردن.
It's not a good act in and by itself to then hold others accountable for banning it.
اتفاقا اسمش آزادی هم نیست.
And it's not called freedom either.
ولی اگر کسی تو خونه خودش در خفا کاری بکنه کاریش نداره کسی.
Sure, if somebody engages in an act in their own house without being known to others, we don't pay any attention to that.
در محدوده شخصی خودشون افراد کاری میکنن آزاده.
People are free to do what they like in their private realms.
اما کسی نمیتونه کار خلاف قانون رو در ملأ عام انجام بده.
But nobody can engage in what breaks the law in public.
چرا در غرب همه این مرزهای اخلاقی متلاشی شده؟
Why is it that in the West all moral boundaries have been shaken?
برای اینکه یه عده میخوان رأی بیارن، حاضرن هر کار غیر اخلاقی رو مجاز بشمارن؟
Just because some people want to get votes, they are ready to overlook every morality.
این به ضرر جامعه است.
This goes against the values of a society.
دستور پیامبران الهی است.
It is the divine rule of the prophets.
البته در ایران اینجوری که در اینجا مطرحه در اونجا مطرح نیست اصلا.
And then of course in Iran it's not an issue as big as it is of concern here in the United States.
ممکنه افراد معدودی باشن.
There might be a few people.
و ناشناخته.
Who are unknown.
فضای عمومی کشور ما مخالفه با این.
In general our country would not accept it.
و قانون هم هست.
And there's a law about it too.
قانون باید تبعیت.
Which one must follow?
July 19th is a day that is honored around the world that where two gay teenagers, Iranian teens, were hung. This is a picture of them hanging. They were two young men named Mahmoud Asghari and Ayaz Marhouni. Do you think gay men and lesbians should die in Iran?
No, ma hamchun qanuni nadarim baraye edame inha dar Iran.
No, there's no law for their execution in Iran.
Ina momchene qachaqshi budan ya kasi ro kushtan.
Either they were drug traffickers or they had killed someone else.
Kasani ke afradi ro bokoshan va tajavuz be onf ro konan va naamni ijad konan ممکنه مجازاتشون اعدام.
Those who kill someone else or engage in acts of rape might could be punished by execution.
والله اونا که همجنسگرا هستن اصلا شناخته نمیشن که بخوان اعدام بشن.
Otherwise homosexuals are not even known who they are to be hung in the second place.
ما نداریم مجازات اعدام برای اونا.
So we don't have execution.
کار ممنوعیه، کار زشتیه.
Of course we consider it an abhorrent act.
اما مجازاتش اعدام نیست.
But it is not punished by capital punishment through capital punishment. It's basically an immoral act.
خیلی کارها غیر اخلاقی است اما مجازات اعدام نداره.
There are a lot of acts that can be immoral, but there's no capital punishment for them.
Now we're joined on the phone by the Iranian-American activist Kudosh Shamirani from Queer Iran Alliance. He's published widely on the subject of how international gay rights advocacy about Iran can face the danger of slipping into pro-war propaganda. Kudosh, welcome to Democracy Now! Your overall response to the Iranian president's comments on the issue of the hanging of the young gay teens.
That has not really been proven. There's been a big debate about that from the human rights organizations about whether they were hung because they were gay. So even, you know, bringing that up with him, I think, is a little tricky. And he was able to dismiss it, and the government has been able to dismiss that accusation easily because the case itself was never brought to light, and it's not the fact that it's not known. But what he basically said that was quite interesting is that he said that, you know, homosexuality or sodomy is not punishable by death in Iran, which is, of course, not true. There is that law in Iran. And in another sense, it is true because there's so many different laws on the books that that negate this one law that you can say that that doesn't exist on the books. I mean, the legal system in Iran is so complicated that you can have a law that says one thing and many laws are negated, and that's the case with sodomy. So in a way, him being forced to say that the law doesn't exist is a continuation of him trying to sort of cover for himself. And then Larry King interviewed the day before, 2 days ago, he basically said that the government does not go into people's private lives, and people's private homes is their own place. We do not intervene in what they do to their own home, which is again not true. So he's trying to sort of put a nicer face on the various policies and the various things that happen to Iranians in general, gay Iranians in particular. And at this point, I'm not really sure where it's going.
Democracy Now!'s Amy Goodman spoke with Kudosh Shamirani of Queer Iran Alliance following their exclusive interview with Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, Tanya Kane Perry, Donna Ann Ward, Rex Walkner with Bill Kelly, and Sherry Lund contributed program material. Thanks also to Melinda Tuhus and Free Speech Radio News, and to Amy Goodman and Democracy Now! Alan Cumming sang Married, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out is made possible by charitable donations from our listeners. Thank you. Log on to thiswayout.org to subscribe to podcasts of your favorite international LGBT radio show. You can also subscribe to CDs or cassettes of our programs and support our work there. To receive our weekly program email alerts, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on KHEN Salida, Colorado, Experiment FM, Ames, Iowa, 3OCR, Colac, Victoria, and more than 175 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
This is 93.3 WMRB Wausau.
Free people, free radio.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
The presidential debates are over and party lines are drawn, but there's at least one thing that some members of both parties can agree on. The debate format isn't working for the American people. The Open Debate Coalition was started by Stanford professor Lawrence Lessig and includes organizations like Media Matters for America, Color of Change, and Free Press, along with Red State and Newt Gingrich's American Solutions. The group was formed during the primary season to ensure video footage of the debates could be shared without fear of breaking copyright law. All of the networks agreed to release their footage except Fox. Adam Green, director of strategic campaigns for MoveOn.org, said it was a big win, which fueled the push to open the presidential debates.
We got back together and asked that video rights be freed up, and also that for the town hall debate, internet questions supposedly asked by the people were actually chosen by the people, as opposed to being chosen by TV producers and put in the mouths of real people.
The coalition wrote a letter to both candidates asking that these two principles be adopted. The answers were somewhat surprising.
Both presidential campaigns said they agreed with them, which marks a huge precedent that we now can carry with us forward. We're still going to be asking that video rights of the debates be released publicly by the Commission on Presidential Debates and by the networks. But overall, we are going to have an agenda of reforming the Commission on Presidential Debates so that they are truly accountable to the people and transparent. It's shocking that both presidential campaigns can agree on anything, let alone this, and have a broad coalition agree on this, and that they still would be completely non-responsive. That shows that there's a fundamental breakdown in our democracy, and this entity needs to be reformed so debates represent the will of the people. And we're going to take this precedent of both major party candidates agreeing to these principles and bring it with us into 2009, 2010, congressional races, state and local races, and essentially try to reshuffle the norms so that openness is the new norm, so that video rights are freely put into the public domain by those who organize debates, so that questions, quote-unquote, from the public actually are from the public, and so that, in general, there is not this high and mighty debate commission attitude, and instead, people really have ownership of debates.
For more information about the Open Debate Coalition, go to opendebatecoalition.org.
Do you know if your internet service provider sells your personal information to other companies? How about the websites you visit? Are they keeping your information private? Or are they selling information on your clicks and purchases to advertisers? Or saving it in case the government wants to take a look? To find out, you have to read their privacy policies. But be ready to spend some time. If everyone read the privacy policies of every website they visited for a year, it would cost in lost time about $3,000, or $365 billion for the entire country. That's according to a new study by Alicia McDonald and Professor Lori Faith Craner of Carnegie Mellon University. McDonald says even skimming a policy takes time.
For skimming policies and answering comprehension questions, we measure that as about 6 minutes per policy. And that's across an estimated 1,200 unique websites per person visited each year. So that works out to being over about 100 hours, about 112 hours per person to skim online privacy policies.
McDonald decided to do the study because of an industry leader's concept of privacy practices.
Well, I got a little frustrated. Last May, I read comments from a CEO that suggested his company should be able to do anything they want to with customer data because they disclose all of their practices and people don't read their privacy policies. And so his take on this was that since people don't read the policies, that means they don't care. And I looked at it and said, well, people don't read the policies because they're really annoying to read, and maybe we need to do a better job. Maybe we need an entirely different approach to online privacy protections.
Congress has already held a series of hearings about privacy, and some companies are beginning to do a better job of disclosure. McDonald thinks mandating more information might just lead to policies that are even more difficult to read. Instead, she says, we might get more benefit from better privacy practices.
And if companies cannot do a better job on protecting privacy for their consumers, then the call for regulation will only grow louder.
McDonald says consumers need to be more aware of privacy policies and how they are leaving information on the web.
Consumers need to think about their privacy footprint in general. What information are they giving out and how could it be used in a different context? They can also just think about what information they're leaving, like a breadcrumb trail across the internet.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
You know you only had one shot to make it right, to do the right thing. So listen to the Mike Cannon Show.
Welcome to the weekly radio spin, a look at the stories behind the news, brought to you by the Center for Media and Democracy. I'm Diane Farsetta.
And I'm Sari Williams. In our top spin, these are hard times for the Securities and Exchange Commission, or SEC. The U.S. agency is tasked with overseeing the financial industry. But the ongoing economic crisis has everyone from pundits to members of Congress to a former SEC chair saying the agency failed to do its job. Even the SEC's own Inspector General recently released a report documenting how the agency failed to supervise brokerage firms. The SEC responded by hiring new public relations and policy advisors. One is a former Bush administration and Senate communications aide who left the PR firm Clark & Weinstock to take the position at the SEC. Another runs his own PR firm and served as a spokesman for former House Speaker Newt Gingrich. The SEC's last new advisor worked in the Reagan administration and headed the Congressional Budget Office.
Where you see an impending ecological crisis and an inadequate response from world governments, he sees business opportunities. Writing about the December 2009 International Climate Change meeting, an executive with the PR firm Edelman called it, quote, "the biggest global opportunity for carbon messaging," end quote. International negotiators and environmentalists believe the 2009 meeting, called COP15, will be the make-or-break point for a binding agreement to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. The Edelman executive called it, quote, "a major opportunity for all my U.S. clients to go well beyond their European counterparts in the green image wars," end quote. He urged corporate executives to attend the COP15 meeting, which will be held in Denmark. He pointed out, quote, "where do you think every respected environmental reporter on the planet will be?" End quote.
This year's U.S. presidential election has seen its share of negative campaigning. But believe it or not, donations to the outside groups known as 527s are down more than $100 million compared to 2004. That doesn't mean that there aren't new 527s running outrageous ads. For example, this spot comes from a group called Born Alive Truth.
Can you imagine not giving babies their basic human rights, no matter how they entered our world? My name's Gianna Jessen, born 31 years ago after a failed abortion. But if Barack Obama had his way, I wouldn't be here.
Born Alive Truth accuses Democratic presidential candidate Barack Obama of supporting infanticide. The nonpartisan group FactCheck.org found that Obama consistently explained his votes on the bills in question as defending abortion rights. Thanks to a Supreme Court ruling, 527s like these can run ads in the election's final days, unlike in 2004.
What does a favorable ruling from a Food and Drug Administration panel cost? Maybe $5 million? The chair of an FDA panel considering the safety of bisphenol A has come under scrutiny for accepting a $5 million grant from a defender of the chemical. The grant was made to the University of Michigan Risk Science Center, which the FDA panel chair founded and co-directs. The grant is nearly 25 times larger than the center's annual budget. But the chair says the donation won't affect his panel's ruling on bisphenol A, which is expected soon. Bisphenol A is a chemical found in water bottles, baby bottles, and aluminum cans, among other household items. Hundreds of studies have linked bisphenol A to health problems, including cancer, heart disease, and reproductive failures. Of the few studies that did not find a negative impact from bisphenol A, most were funded by the chemical industry.
Now it's time to play 6 Degrees of Spin and Fakin', our look at the connections between media manipulators. Earlier, we mentioned the anti-Obama 527 group, Born Alive Truth. Its public relations firm is Creative Response Concepts. That's the same PR firm that worked for perhaps the most infamous 527, the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth. Creative Response Concepts has also worked for numerous Republican National Election Committees and conservative groups, including the National Abstinence Education Association, the Christian Coalition, and the Parents Television Council. The Virginia-based PR firm also counts major corporations among its clients, such as AT&T, Time Warner, Viacom, and Walt Disney.
That's this week's edition of the Weekly Radio Spin. For more information, visit the Center for Media and Democracy's website at www.prwatch.org.
When it takes a white, big city sheriff to stand for the rights of renters, then we know the nation faces a profound political as well as economic crisis. Cook County, Illinois Sheriff Tom Dart, the lawman in charge of foreclosure evictions in Chicago, played the role of Gary Cooper in the 1952 movie High Noon when he stood up for residents facing summarily being put out in the streets through no fault of their own. Sheriff Dart's conscience would not allow him to continue enforcing rubber stamp eviction orders, expelling tenants, many of whom had never fallen behind in their rent or were even aware that their landlord had failed to pay his mortgage. What makes the sheriff a hero of the Gary Cooper kind is that he and those who advocate for tenants' rights in the current crisis stand nearly alone. The national housing debate, what there is of it, focuses almost exclusively on the plight of homeowners, the millions of low- and middle-income renters who never agreed to take on a monthly bill they could not afford and who confront a rental market that is tighter and more expensive every year are treated as less worthy of compassion and protection. Many of the families that are now being evicted from homes they purchased were renters, and they will become renters again. African Americans are disproportionately renters and will become more so as the housing bubble fizzles and the jobs picture worsens. In Sheriff Dart's Cook County, 42% of the population are renters. 58% of blacks in the Chicago region rent their homes. In New York City, only one-third of the 8 million residents and just 28% of blacks are homeowners. Housing is a rental issue in much of urban America. Even before the bubble burst, relentless gentrification had pushed inner-city renters to the breaking point and beyond. Majorities now pay more than 35% of their income for rent. Many more pay more than half their income just to keep a roof over their heads. The hyper-gentrification in New York has placed tens of thousands of tenants at special risk. According to an October 6th article in the New York Times, housing complexes containing 54,000 apartments in Harlem, the South Bronx, and Brooklyn face foreclosure because their speculating landlords bet they could empty the buildings and bring in higher-paying tenants. The speculators took out huge mortgages on the properties in anticipation of higher incomes from new renters. But the tenants held on to their apartments, and now the landlords may go bust. The landlords, of course, are victims of their own greed. But what about the tenants? Who is going to keep up these buildings, home to a population as large as a medium-sized city? The United States has never even begun to achieve federal goals in creating affordable housing, not in all the years since the Great Depression ushered in a national housing policy. The numbers tell the tale. Demand for affordable rental housing is increasing, while the number of available units decreases. People in search of affordable housing are getting poorer, and that was before the crash. There can be no solution to the housing crisis unless affordable rental housing is part of the equation. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
Ever since the 2000 presidential election debacle in Florida, the winner of which was decided by the U.S. Supreme Court, the integrity of American elections has been in doubt. In 2002, Congress passed the Help America Vote Act, which allocated millions of dollars for the purchase of electronic voting machines, which came with privatized software systems and vulnerability to manipulation, creating another set of problems and mistrust. The Help America Vote Act also asks states to remove the names of voters who have died, moved out of state, or no longer qualify to vote. BBC TV investigative reporter Greg Palast, who first reported the illegal purging of voters in Florida prior to the 2000 election, has been raising the alarm about a similar pattern of voter purges in key battleground states in advance of this year's presidential ballot. Now, the New York Times has picked up the story and recently confirmed that tens of thousands of voters in at least six swing states have been removed from the rolls or have been blocked from registering in ways that appear to violate federal law. Because of the Democratic Party's success at registering hundreds of thousands of new voters this year, the culling of the voting rolls will disproportionately affect voters backing Barack Obama. Mark Crispin Miller, professor of media, culture, and communication at New York University, is the editor of a new book titled Loser Take All, Election Fraud and the Subversion of Democracy, 2000 to 2008. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Miller about the evidence he says suggests that a concerted effort is being made by the Republican Party to change the outcome of this November's election, including efforts, possibly now underway, to steal the election by rigging the electronic vote.
The Republicans are necessarily resorting to a dizzying range of tactics, some of them legal, many of them illegal, to do two things, basically. On the one hand, they're working very, very hard at vote suppression. And that's a category of activities that's familiar to anyone who's, you know, paid any attention to American history. It's the kind of thing that goes back to the days of Jim Crow. We're talking about new laws that have been passed to require voters to bring certain kinds of documents to the polls. We're talking about major efforts to interfere with registration drives. We're talking about a kind of national orgy of voter purging. That is, the names of voters are being purged from the rolls in state after state after state. And this category of activity also includes disinformation, sending people to the wrong polling place, intimidating them with threats that if they show up to vote, they'll be arrested because they have fallen behind in their child support payments or they have outstanding parking tickets. I mean, I could talk to you for the next half hour just about scams like these. So that's going on all over the place. And at the same time, and this is a category of activity that gets much less attention because it's still controversial, at least to the corporate media, and that is the apparatus is in place for more election fraud. This refers not to, you know, shrinking the size of the electorate before Election Day and keeping people out of the polls. This refers to basically fixing the numbers electronically after the fact, that is, after people have voted. And this involves the use of electronic voting systems, which now basically will account for between 85 and 90% of the votes cast in this country. I started out by saying the Republicans are doing this necessarily because it seems to me that they can't win this race in any other way. I think the polls by now have made quite clear, and I've discussed this with a number of my friends in the polling business, that McCain is toast, and indeed the Republican Party would be finished, I think, if it weren't for election fraud. I think the Republican Party actually would have been finished a couple of years ago if it weren't for election fraud. So my main concern at the moment is that there be as large a turnout as possible, because the larger the turnout, the harder it is to steal an election. And I'm also eager to see this be the most vigilantly monitored election we've ever had. And the good news is that there's every indication that, on the one hand, the turnout will be very big, and on the other hand, that people will indeed be very carefully monitoring the race.
Mark, as you said before, we have to be psychologically prepared for a surprise Republican victory in November. And you've also said resistance is critical. But what form should that resistance take? What should people have in the back of their mind as we go in to look at the results on election night, November 4th?
Well, you know, as to exactly what we can do in such a situation, I'm really not equipped to say because we're in uncharted territory. But I want to leave you with something much more specific that I referred to before that your listeners absolutely must know about because it can do a great deal to prevent the theft of this election, actually. And in the event of a theft, can strengthen the hand of those who say no, okay? What we now have coming out of Ohio is a revelation of immeasurable importance. We have the testimony of a whistleblower whose credentials are unimpeachable. This guy's name, this expert witness, is named Stephen Spoonamore, S-P-O-O-N-A-M-O-R-E. I say that he has unimpeachable credentials because, first of all, he's a conservative Republican. Second of all, he's a former McCain supporter. And third of all, he makes his living as a very prominent and highly successful expert on the detection of computer fraud. Spoonamore's testimony is driving a RICO lawsuit in Ohio. But the most important thing for people to know now is that Spoonamore has named Karl Rove's computer guru, who has helped Rove to steal elections since 2000 when he helped with Florida. He helped with Ohio in 2004. He helped to steal Don Siegelman's reelection victory as governor of Alabama in 2002. The evidence suggests that he helped with the theft of Senator Max Cleland's reelection in Georgia in 2002. Connell is now working for the McCain campaign, and we understand that they have a system in place that will allow them to steal the race in Ohio and five other swing states, okay? And the game plan here is to use the process of discovery in this lawsuit so that we can get these people under oath and on the record answering specific questions about their crimes. The fact is that if people want to learn more about what Spoonamore has revealed, and if they want to donate to the legal war chest to enable the lawyers to push this thing to the max, they can go to a website. The URL is www.rovecybergate.com. People should go there immediately. They can watch some video interviews with Spoonamore. So I want, you know, to leave you tonight with this information because this is something that will really make a difference, but only if people pay attention to it and act on it as soon as possible.
That was Mark Crispin Miller, professor of media, culture, and communication at New York University and editor of the book, Loser Take All. Visit his website at markcrispinmiller.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Chris Ferriero, Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
For this episode of In Season with Lisa, we are back to squash. Today I'm going to tell you how to make a vegan squash soup that is so delicious you'll never know what you're missing. And just for the record, I am neither a vegetarian nor a vegan, not even close.
But the richness of squash blended with Thai curry and coconut milk makes an amazing autumn soup. This curried soup is also very easy and comes together in about half an hour or less. I am particularly fond of using the Japanese kabocha squash for this recipe because it has a very rich and full flavor, almost like a sweet potato, and it doesn't have the fibrous quality you find in many winter squashes, so there's no straining needed for a soup as smooth as silk. You will need 3 large kabocha squashes. You could also use butternut, in which case use 2 medium squash. Cut the squash in half lengthwise and scoop out the seeds. Cut each half of the squash into rough quarters and place in a steamer insert and place over boiling water. Sprinkle the squash with salt, cover, and steam for about 20 minutes to half an hour, or until the squash is very soft. Remove it from the heat and allow it to cool enough so that you can scoop the flesh from the skin and set it aside. In a large soup pot, heat a pinch of olive oil over medium heat and add a tablespoon of ginger garlic puree, a great shortcut ingredient for Asian cooking of all sorts, and stir for about a minute. Add 1 can of coconut milk, light or full fat, and an equal amount of water or vegetable stock. Bring this to a simmer and add 2 tablespoons of Thai red curry paste, which can be found in a small jar in the Asian section of any well-stocked grocery store. Add 1/4 cup of brown sugar or 2 tablets of palm sugar, which can be found at Lac Viet in the North Market. Add the squash and puree everything with a stick blender. Taste and adjust seasoning as needed. This soup is so easy to make that when I posted a similar recipe on my website last fall, a college student emailed to let me know she had made it in her dorm room with great success. From RestaurantWidow.com, I'm Lisa the Waitress, and you've been listening to In Season with Lisa on WCRS LPFM, Columbus Community Radio.
you know what they said? Well, some of it was true. London calling at the top of the dial. And after all this, won't you give me a smile? London calling. I never felt so much alike.
Sunday afternoons, tune into Respect Radio with your host, DJ Roadblock. That's Strictly Roots in Reggae Culture every Sunday from 4 to 6 p.m. That's Respect Radio Sundays from 4 to 6 only on 93.3 WNRB LP Wausau, your free people, free radio, community radio station.